for this episode is War Stories, Lessons Learned from the Battlefield. I have Joe and Shaw from Assault Forward, and they're going to share their lessons learned for their time in combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. Buckle up. Enjoy. All right. What's up, guys?
Hey, Justin. How's it going?
Hey, Justin.
All right. Yeah, going well here. Can't complain living on an island in the middle of the Pacific, but yeah, it's good. About 80 degrees and pretty good surf coming in. Nice. So everybody's jealous.
Very nice. Well, we're coming to you again from the most powerful city on the face of the earth, Washington, D.C. And it's beautiful springtime here. The cherry blossoms have faded, but the swamp summer has not set in yet. So we're in that blissful period in D.C. where the weather's actually pretty nice as well. So things are good in Assault Forward land.
Awesome. Awesome. I know we talked a number of weeks ago just kind of about your guys' story and what you guys did in the service a little bit, but out of the service as well with your company, Assault Forward. Pretty cool stuff. I put your products up on my Amazon page. But yeah, I think, you know, as we were talking a little bit back and forth, just diving in a little bit into your time there in combat and as I do on my podcast, just kind of sharing your time there, maybe whether it's a funny story or whatever you guys feel would be impactful for those that are listening. I think that would be a pretty good use of our time.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So, I mean, I know after we were on a couple of weeks ago and, you know, listen to your stories that you've told since then, we've gotten some direct messages, some questions, and people do reach out. I know your mission of inspiring the next generation of warfighters. So the folks that are considering military service really across any branch, I think our stories from the Army perspective, your stories from the Navy perspective, they cross all boundaries and, people can enjoy them and learn from them, no matter what branch of service they're considering. So, yeah, I had the opportunity to do 3 combat deployments, each one for about a year. So I did 2 years in Afghanistan and then did my year in Iraq. Really interesting, diverse experiences for me. So first deployment, 10th Mountain Division, I was assigned as a fire support officer, the artilleryman that's attached to a light infantry company. And so we went over there. Our battalion was spread out in kind of northeast Afghanistan, I guess, from based on Bagram Airfield, but then spread out through kind of the mountains in the east and a couple different bases, a couple different missions there. We had the opportunity to go out and go up to a city called Nangalam up the Pesh River Valley, kind of north of Asadabad for some folks that might have been there. And kind of established a base up there that was there for many years after we left. That was kind of one big mission we did, and then had a chance to set up a new series of bases around Ghazni, over in Ghazni province, and we were there for a couple months. That was kind of through the end of our deployment. We were based down there in Ghazni. So, you know, our commander went out on like a helicopter reconnaissance mission and like spotted a potential spot to build a base. And as a light infantry company, we built a base from the ground up, you know, and all the fun stuff that goes from, you know, living in the middle of nowhere to, you know, digging trenches, mortar positions, filling sandbags, filling HESCO barriers, putting in piss tubes and cutting 55-gallon cans in half to make shitters. Which we rotated. Even the young lieutenant took his turn stirring with a picket, you know, with the diesel gasoline mix. Because as I learned, you know, gas burns hot and fast, diesel burns low and slow. So you got to mix your fuels as you stir your shit to get it to burn off. So all kinds of fun stuff like that. Learning the finer points of putting in those piss tubes. You know, you want your fine gravel base, but then you want the larger river rock so that the piss has somewhere to dissipate into the ground. And every few months, you'll have to move your piss tubes so they don't fill up too much. And putting a screen on the top to prevent guys from putting their cigarettes down the tube was also a very important thing so they didn't get jammed up. So these are the finer points of living in the Afghan wilderness that you learn on deployment over the time. But, you know, great experiences out there in the field, not showering for a couple months, you know, doing the baby wipe baths and finding a cold canteen cup of water to scrape your face every morning because you still had to shave and maintain those field hygiene standards. So different things there. And then The next year I spent in Afghanistan, a totally different experience for me. I was attached to the command group of the 10th Mountain Division. I served as a general officer's aide to camp, and that was a totally different experience. So I was based on Bagram for that whole year, but had the opportunity to go out a couple times a week with my boss, and he was really big on the battlefield circulation. So we were getting on helicopters all the time and pretty much visiting troops all over the country. And so that was a really neat experience. I've pretty much been to like every base in Afghanistan through that deployment, visiting small outposts on the top of a mountain to the large bases throughout the country. So very interesting experience there. And the interesting thing with the military, you never know what's going to happen. So I'll tell you my first story was that. So I was assigned to a light infantry company for a year, and we took some indirect fire sometimes, maybe a few pot shots on patrols, some IEDs, which at that time they weren't really sophisticated IEDs. They would just bury an anti-tank mine in the road, dirt roads, dig it up, put an anti-tank mine that was left over from the Russians, stuff like that. So did that whole year with the infantry company. But then as an aide de camp to a general officer, got in the most complex and longest firefight engagement of my career. We were coming in to land. We were a chalk of two UH-60 Black Hawk helicopters coming in to land at a place called the Korngal Outpost, KOP. There's been movies and books called Restrepo.
I was just thinking about that actually when you were
mentioning. Yeah, so there's some lot of history over the course of the war in Afghanistan up the Peshawar River Valley and the Korngal Outpost. And so we were going to visit. We had an infantry company based there, and we were going in for a landing. And as usual, when you're coming with a general officer, the company commander is going to come out to greet the helicopter. A couple guys come out usually do a quick meet right there. The helicopters, it's really noisy when you're getting off the helicopter. You got the rotor wash kicking up some dust and dirt. And so you're kind of, and you have ear pro in usually when you're riding on the helicopter, or you had the headset on the helicopter, you take it off and you're coming out. So you're a little disoriented as far as the sounds going on around you and things like that. So we're getting off the helicopter.
And what was your purpose? What was the purpose of your guys' visit? I mean, you went to all these different, you just trying to get the state of affairs at each one of these outposts. I mean, assess their capabilities.
Yeah, I think,
where their shortfalls
for are. the general, he was the deputy commanding general for support for the Combined Joint Task Force in Afghanistan. So he was checking on the troops, checking on the morale of the troops, getting updates from the commanders. You got to get out and see it and feel it. There's only so much you can get through reports back at the big base. And so he was really big on conducting battlefield circulation to get out there and really see the troops, talk to the troops, find out how they're doing. Get the needs, find out from the commander what unmet needs do you have that he could potentially influence, resources, whether it's, assets or firepower or, control over, drones or, fast movers or rotary wing assets, things like that. So, it was just a routine battlefield circulation mission. So, so we're getting off the helicopters. It's loud, it's dusty, can't really see too much. You're getting on, I think we see the commander and his group that's come out to greet the helicopters, and kind of notice they're kind of crouching low over by the HESCO barriers that are kind of the edge of the HLZ, the helicopter landing zone. And pretty soon you do figure out through people's body language and reaction that they're taking fire, that they're not just ducking down to avoid the rotor wash of the Blackhawks or things like that. Like we're getting shot at. And so kind of quickly move over to the edge of the HESCOs where they are and kind of follow them. Cause again, we've never been to this base before, so we don't really know where is safe, where's a bunker, where's a protective barrier we can get behind, what's going on. So we kind of like, you're kind of, again, it's loud. You can't really hear the shots, but then the Blackhawks real quickly take off. They're going to get out of there, right? Because they're just sitting ducks, and they're spinning hot, so they're ready to go. So as soon as we get off them, they're back up in the air, and so we follow these guys into their tactical outpost and get behind some HESCO barriers and figure out what's going on. And at that point, now you can really hear what's happening, and we're asking these guys, like, we know the Korngal outpost takes engagement from time to time. So like, what's going on? They're like, no. This is a big deal. This is, we're under attack. So it's like, oh, all right. Like, What do we need us to do? You know, so when you're traveling with around the country, not only do you fly in the Blackhawks, but you also have a pair of Apache, the AH-64 attack helicopters. You have a pair of Apache escorts, and their job is to protect the relatively lightly armed Blackhawks, right? Blackhawks just have a door gunner. He's got maybe a 249, you know, nothing too crazy to protect the Blackhawks. So you have those Apaches that are purely attack helicopters, you know, and they're loaded up, ready to rumble. So quickly give the call signs of our Apache escorts to the commander. He gets in touch with them. So they're starting to engage some hillsides. So it turns out it was a pretty complex three-sided ambush that the Afghan resistance or whoever they were at the time, you know, had put up. So they're engaging the Korungal outpost from three different sides, and they've got a mix of RPGs, mortars, and small arms and machine gun fire coming in at us from three sides. And
so this is pretty close. It's a few hundred yards out. What time
really
of day?
Close. Yeah. Midday, high sun, you know, full daylight hours. You know, this is, so I think, you know, basically what we figured out in the aftermath is that the helicopter's landing was what basically they initiated the attack based on that. They were like, they might have a chance to get a helicopter. So us landing, unfortunately, was actually the event that triggered the ambush or attack. So they opened up. And so there's a mortar section there with the infantry company. They're rocking and rolling. They start popping mortars, you know, hang it, fire. And they're shooting mortars back at the surrounding hillsides where the attack's coming from. You've got the Apaches overhead. They're shooting their rockets and guns, you know, blasting up targets as well. And then you've got infantrymen throughout the Korungal outpost that are obviously shooting back in direct fire. And then in addition to that right there, they also had a couple of OPs around that are reporting in, you know, distance and direction of where they're taking fire from or where they see us taking fire from. So they're trying to help coordinate our response. And so as you know, I mean, these things, they feel like they're taking hours, and then like in a matter of, you know, 15, 20 minutes, they're over. Cause it's a fast and furious engagement, and then it passes. So, again, I don't know the exact timing of it, but you know, it seemed like it took a long time. And then next thing you know, it's over and the enemy's retreated away. You've beat back the attack. So we, you know, kind of catch our breath, go around, see what's going on the base. Had one of the mortar section soldiers had taken a shot kind of right through his forearm, kind of through and through, really right through his forearm. So he had gone to their kind of tactical aid station or field aid station there, and they had wrapped and bandaged that up. So he was there. We were traveling with a chaplain, a Navy chaplain actually. And so he and his chaplain's assistant were kind of with that wounded soldier to kind of, you know, comforting him, giving him comfort and morale. So he was with us, kind of go around, and we're kind of taking stock of the damage. So they had like a water tower, kind of big holding thing that had taken an RPG round. We found an unexploded RPG round that had actually lodged itself in one of the HESCO barriers. So for folks that don't know what a HESCO barrier is, it's basically like this earthen barrier. So it's got a fabric liner and a metal cage around it. And they come flat, collapse, and then you open them up and you can fill them with dirt to create like a wall or a barrier. And they come in all different sizes and stuff. But so in that kind of cloth and dirt barrier, we found like the tail fin of an RPG sticking out. So we're like, okay, glad that didn't go off, because that was like right outside the dock. So yeah, your situational awareness, and it's something you talk about, you know, your plans may change, right? So in combat, you kind of always got to be ready. And that's something, you know, you train and you talk to your soldiers about all the time, is that you never know when it's going to pop off. And so, you know, you do a lot of patrols, a lot of foot patrols, a lot of mounted patrols, you know, a lot of air assault missions. You know, you do all kinds of different things, and you train and train and train, and you never know which one may require you guys to act. So I think that preparation and training and being ready to go at any time is really critical. So we talk a lot, you know, on the course of a year long deployment about fighting complacency and, you know, beating back, you know, trying to keep your guys ready at all times so they don't get soft, you know, because you never know which patrol you're going to have IEDs go off, disable vehicles. You got to do different things. Like you never know, And so you got to be ready. So the, that was kind of a crazy one. But so the story for me though, is that, you know, even though I my first year in Afghanistan was with a light infantry company, I never had as complex or sustained an engagement as I had when I was a general officer's aide, you know, supposedly an easier tour. We're flying around just, you know, giving mission updates to folks and checking on bases. So kind of always be ready, because you never know when it's going to go. But so to wrap that story up, our Blackhawks came back. We loaded up. We took the wounded soldier with us and flew down the valley to Assadabad, where there was a more robust medical team there. I think they had a surgeon and some. It was like a forward operating surgical center or something like that. So we flew down there with the casualty, evac'd him down there. They did a little bit of work there. Found out that the Blackhawks had in fact taken some rounds. So they did, the crew chiefs and pilots were doing an assessment of the birds, making sure those were good. And then, we ended up loading back up and going back to Bagram with the casualty, 'cause that was really where the whole hospital, Bagram had a full hospital set up there. So we took our Blackhawks, and instead of landing on the usual flight line, we went straight to where the medevac helicopters usually land, right outside the hospital off of Steel Beach there. For the guys that were in Afghanistan in the early days, they had, you know, Bagram was originally, I think, built by the Soviets during the 80s. And so they had this like metal apron that was called Steel Beach, where the flight line was for the helicopters. So landed there and took, got the patient and casualty inside. And it was great opportunities. Name was Sergeant Vile, William Vile. And unfortunately, probably the saddest part of the story is that a couple years later, we learned that then Staff Sergeant Vile was killed on a subsequent tour. And so he had earned a Purple Heart that year. And we had the opportunity to CASVAC him and take care of him. And then we were notified a couple years later, both the general I worked for and myself, by his commander, that he had been killed. So he's buried down there in Section 60 at Arlington National Cemetery. And I've had the opportunity to go down and visit his tombstone there in that sea of post 9/11 casualties, all in Section 60 there in Arlington. So anybody has a chance to visit DC, it's worth a trip across the Potomac over there at Arlington to check out Section 60 and see some of our brothers and sisters that have passed in Afghanistan and Iraq and subsequent battles. So,
yeah, no doubt about it. That's a humbling experience for sure. And hey, so to step back a little bit in your story there, I mean, you guys landed right in the thick of it, which unbeknownst to you was happening when you landed. And I guess the advantage there as you got onto the base is you had the Apaches overhead. I mean, That's usually you're trying to call for that air support to come in, and there they were right there. I mean, that was good timing on the enemy's part, bad timing on the enemy's part, right?
No, absolutely. Yeah, it was a huge asset. Yeah, because my first deployment as a fire support officer, I was kind of like the primary communicator with those rotary wing assets. So I used to be the, you know, Comanche 3-5, you know, calling, talking to the Apache pilots and, you know, waiting for them to get on station if there was contact, because they weren't always overhead. You know, they were off. You know, there's a lot of times there's stuff up in the air, but you had to wait for it to get to you. You know, either rotary wing or the fast movers coming off an aircraft carrier somewhere really far away. You know, they had time on station and you were always trying to get them. We had Marine Cobras, which are loud as can be if they shoot their rockets. I had never heard one before. I'd never trained with Marines, but those Marine Cobra pilots are amazing. They will come low, they will come fast, and they will shoot whatever you tell them to shoot. And I can tell you those rockets coming off the rails of a Cobra are really, really loud, especially at night when you're in a quiet village. And next thing you know, they're shooting some rounds off for you, which is awesome. I remember that. But yeah, talking to Apaches, talking to Blackhawks, you know, talking to the fast movers, F-16s, whatever else was on station for us. You know, they would do a check-in brief with us, and then we talked to them. So for that particular event, it was lucky that our escort was with us. The enemy made a calculation there that they were going to try and get these helicopters that had landed at this remote outpost, the Korngal outpost, but then also maybe they didn't know, I don't know, the Apaches tended to stay back a little bit, be up a little bit higher, especially when you're, when the Blackhawks are landing, the Apaches tend to go up a little bit or go out a little bit to run some racetracks or take laps around the base, you know, kind of at a higher perspective. So yeah, it was an opportunity that the enemies wanted to take advantage of, but then it was a great opportunity for us to get back in. And, you know, I mean, young guys that are listening to this, young gals that want to go in the military, I mean, this, you think about the complexity of that operation, but you have 11 Charlies, mortarmen, you have 11 Bravos, infantrymen, you have aviation assets, and you have to deconflict that. We always say, you know, being an artilleryman myself, you know, big sky, little bullet, but you don't want those mortars going near those helicopters. And so you got to deconflict either by altitude or a grid line or something. You know, you stay north of this, we'll shoot south of this, or you stay above this altitude or whatever. But you know, they're shooting mortars off. You got helicopters flying around. You've got, you know, the Blackhawks coming back into land. You've got, you know, infantrymen shooting. There's observation posts, the OPs that the infantry had out there. So obviously you don't want to shoot near your own guys. So, you know, they got to know where those are. So making sure that they don't shoot at those, because they might've been engaging the enemy too. So you can't just go like, hey, what's that muzzle flash? I think I'm going to shoot it. Like, you got to really know what's going on. So as complex as an operation, as it is out there, it's amazing. The symphony, I mean, people call it a symphony, right? Combat. It's there's music to it. When the mortars are humming, the Apaches are shooting, guys are popping off their, you know, everything from an M4 up to a 240 Bravo, you know, 7.62 rocking. And so it's just, it's an amazing experience to be in combat and to witness it up close and to see how it all comes together and how we fight back and how we attack.
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, when you guys repelled the attack and everything started to die out, did the commander like push out a patrol? I mean, do you guys have, you know, enemy killed, that sort of thing, to kind of see where it came from? What was the action after the attack for you guys?
I'm sure they did. unfortunately, we didn't really stick around for that part. So we used our helicopters to get that casualty, that wounded soldier out.
Oh, okay.
So we took off, but I'm definitely, I mean, as a commander myself on a subsequent tour in Iraq, that would absolutely be what you would do. I mean, as soon as you had that, you would be checking in with your OPs and getting a patrol, you know, ready to go out. I think they had some Afghan National Army soldiers at the base, so I'm sure they were pushed out right away to start talking, because there's always a local village or a town or some farmer, shepherd up in the hills nearby that knows what's going on. And so you're going out on patrol, taking an interpreter with you, having a host nation asset with you, like an Iraqi army or an Afghan National Army, you know, troop to go with you is huge, because they can talk to them in a different way than we can and try to get some different information out of them. But I'm sure they were definitely gathering intelligence and trying to figure out where it came from, what happened, you know, what village those guys melted back into. You know, did they come across the border from Pakistan? Where did they, you know, what was going on? And I'm sure that there was definitely some follow-up. And then there's other bases up and down that valley. So I'm sure they were talking and sharing information and being on the lookout for military age males with weapons or whatever, you know. You're sharing information and sending those reports up and down. So it's another part of that coordination and communication to be ready for whatever may happen.
Yeah. Do you remember the name of that outpost? I think the Medal of Honor was awarded out of it. Eventually it was bombed and shut down because it was such a terrible spot. I think it was one of the most remote outposts out there. It was on a river, you know, at the bottom of a valley. I saw a documentary on it recently, and it was really good.
Yeah,
but so same
base,
kind of thing.
I mean, the base we established at Nongalam, and this was back in 2003. That became named Camp Blessing, which was named after an Army Ranger that was killed on a patrol right in that area. So I know there was Blessing, the Korngal outpost. There were several OPs and really remote bases there, and then kind of working down the river, you had Asadabad, and then further down you had Jalalabad. One of those was FOB Fenty, which was named after Lieutenant Colonel Fenty, who was a battalion commander of the 10th Mountain Division that was killed on our tour. So there was Bob Fenty, but there's all those bases. Unfortunately, when you know the history and you've done multiple tours, you kind of know where the names came from. And a lot of those were tough ones, but trying to think. Yeah, there was definitely, because there were some Medal of Honors awarded, and definitely probably some.
Yeah, this one there was an outpost like on the top of the mountain. I'll think of it here in a minute. But as you know, if you looked at this fob, you'd be like, why would they ever put that there? I literally was just cornered on all sides by, you know, like a 3,000-foot mountain. And just the whole story around it was just like, I cannot believe that not everybody died, because that's what happened. They just got assaulted by all sides, and they had troops inside the base. They had enemy in the wire, as they would say, and fighting for the life in there. And so, yeah, some of these, and a lot of people don't realize that, you know, as the base is not primarily, but is a defensive position, but you're constantly pushing the envelope. You're pushing out there and being aggressive, and you know, just like you guys get attacked, you're also, hey, let's push out more, let's walk the streets, let's get out there and not just always be in a defensive position, which it can be most of the time, because you're in somebody else's backyard. They know where you're at. There's no doubt about it. They're watching you more than you're watching them. At least that's the feeling I got cruising around Afghanistan. Some of those border towns, things like that. So, yeah, it's pretty good, man. Just running into a base and just getting in the thick of it right away. So, it's a good story. So,
I don't know. I'm not sure if this is the name you're thinking of, but Sergeant Monty, he was killed in June of 2006 during that deployment, and was posthumously the Medal of Honor. So Sergeant Monty was one of the guys I knew. He was a fire support guy. He was a 13 Fox, so a field artilleryman. I actually trained with him in garrison, and on we did a training exercise down at a air base in Florida prior to that deployment. So I actually knew Sergeant Monty a little bit, because he was an artilleryman, 13 Fox, and he was a good dude.
That's probably the name I'm trying to think of, but. Yeah, that's so you guys didn't, you had one not casualty, but one injured soldier there, and no casualties on that.
Yeah, engagement. That particular engagement, we were very, very fortunate. Yeah, so that infantry company did a great job, had good defenses in place, had good protection in place, and had a good plan in place to execute in the event of an attack. You know, how do you respond? So, you know, having the mortars ready and dialed in, having the ammo prepped and sorted, you know, all that sort of stuff is really critical. So, they were really good. So yeah. And that was part of the Sergeant Vile, the soldier that was shot through the arm and subsequently killed on a later tour. You know, his job in the mortar section was he ran the mortar ballistic computer, and you know, he's punching in calculations, and he stayed on that job even after being wounded. Even after he got shot, he stayed on it until their attack was done. Punching in those calculations to tell the mortar, you know, which elevation, which deflection to shoot, set the tubes, you know, to repel the attack. So, you never know what's inside you until you're tested. And, the crucible of combat can definitely bring out the best in people. And he was one of them. So, hell of a soldier. And there's a lot of soldiers and sailors and Marines out there that have done amazing things. As you talk, a lot of your listeners being the younger guys that are considering military service, and I've heard the term like millennial veteran and different things lately as I listen to different podcasts and get the DMs from folks on our Instagram and stuff like that about considering service. And it's like, I know the greatest generation was World War II generation, but don't worry, guys. There's a lot of goodness in the military today, and a lot of awesome stories of service and sacrifice happening out there. And we have troops deployed right now to dozens of nations around the globe. So I know Red Friday has kind of become a thing, and everybody wear red, remember everyone deployed. That is never lip service to me, because I do know that guys I served with that are still in, and folks that have come after me and after you are deployed around the globe keeping us safe. And it's something to always remember, that there are folks out there 24/7, 365, all around the globe, serving our great nation and doing the Lord's work out there.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, earlier you mentioned just kind of stepping up and getting your whole, battalion deployed out to Afghanistan. And you don't realize, you know, to get to that, tip of the spear where guys are actually, you know, pulling triggers and shooting and things like that, it's the support behind that is just massive. Support, yeah. You know, it takes a lot of resources to bring the fight to the enemy. And a lot of people don't realize what it takes. I think I had 40 support personnel to 10 to 15 man SEAL platoon, just to put that in perspective. And so,
yeah, it's definitely,
you know, we'd never be able to get the enemy without that support. And it's critical, yeah. From doctors or support all the way down to, the brand new guy out there throwing away the trash and burning the shitters and things like that. So it's yeah. Huge.
Okay. You know, hey, Justice Shaw, you know, when we talked about from the last time, you know, kind of a couple of stories and, you know, of course there's tons of stories, but I have, but as same thing, I was a field artillery officer in the Army, and I was in Iraq from May 2003 to July 2004. So I was there in the beginning with the 1st Armored Division, and so much things happened at that point. It was like the Wild Wild West at that time. But a couple of things that I learned, you know, I have kind of 4 shorter stories, concise, and you know, I'll put them out there, and you can give me feedback. But so the first one, I mean, it's kind of the themes that I've learned from my time from deployment. So the first one, I mean, we hear it all the time in the military, complacency kills. And so when we were in Baghdad, and our division, our battalion had one of the first patrol zones out of our FOB and over Baghdad. And we had this route off of kind of Route Irish, no, not route, but off the airport road in Baghdad and that surrounding area. And so I was a platoon leader. I had a platoon. We were out doing patrols every night, just, you know, presence patrols. And this was early on, like after. So it was relatively kind of quiet, but it was every month we were there, started getting progressively worse. But in the beginning, people were still happy that Saddam went down. So this is May 03. Saddam left, you know, March of 03. So 2 months of people were still kind of happy that we were there. So we were out doing patrols, and it was like 1-2 in the morning. And after, you know, there were multiple ways to get back to the FOB. And so I started taking shortcuts, right? We're like, all right, you know, let's get back to, took the same road back kind of 3 nights in a row. Like, hey, let's head back, you know, and again, started getting complacent because we were out there for weeks and, you know, not a single thing happened. So I remember I was on the radio kind of talking to my guys, and I kind of thought to myself, hey, it's 1:30. We're supposed to be out for another half an hour. We could probably call it a little early. It's going to be quiet. Nothing's probably going to happen. Let's just head back. And sure enough, like on the same road, we hit, you know, 2 nights in a row, 3rd night, going back to the FOB, maybe, you know, we're only like probably 5-10 minutes out. Boom, IED goes off on my vehicle, RPGs, small arms fire. And this shortcut back to the FOB, it was kind of like in a little high top kind of area with ravines on both sides. So it's not like somewhere we can get out, dismount, and pull perimeter. You know, it was kind of like a really kind of bad area for us. So, you know, we returned fire as much as we could, kind of exited the area until we got, you know, because we, you know, again, it would have been a bad area for us to dismount because we had, you know, ravines, you know, both sides. So we left the area after, you know, we returned some rounds, you know, pitch black dark, and, you know, got back to the FOB, and we're like, holy crap, you know. And then, you know, it goes back to when you talk about complacency kills, when we did the after action review, it's like, well, obviously we know, you know, lessons learned from there, obviously, yeah, during that deployment, and then just life after. So that's kind of, you know, when we talk about it all the time in business and life, like never stay complacent, always move, always think ahead, not doing the same things over and over. So that was,
yeah. So you guys were, how many vehicles were in your
We had 5 vehicles.
Okay. And the IED vehicle?
I was lead vehicle. So it hit my lead vehicle. So my gunner, who was out, you know, on the 50 cal, he almost fell off the, you know, the Humvee. And so we had to kind of grab him on, and it was pretty bad. Yeah.
And you guys pretty much exited the area after that. But so you had been going over the same route again, or was this the shortcut that you decided like, hey, let's get back quicker. Let's take this shortcut.
So we had a, you know, we had an area, we would kind of randomly, you know, patrol the area, different roads, but then kind of two nights in a row, we took the shortcut back to the FOB, like the one road. It kind of was like a little shortcut, but then we hit that, you know, two nights in a row. So then on the third night is when we got hit with the ID. So they kind of realized like, hey, these guys are on here. And again, up to this point, like we, you know, not, it was, we were out there for a few weeks. You know, this is our first few weeks we're out there patrolling, and you know, and nothing was happening. So we were like, oh, man, it's pretty quiet. You know, we'll be fine. And but again, that's what happens. And next thing you know, boom. And first thing I thought, I was like, holy crap. Like I thought of like a Die Hard movie. I was like, you know, like things going off, bombs going. I was like, holy crap. Like this is real life right now, right? And then first thing I did was I looked to see if my legs were still there. And, you know, everything was fine. And everybody was, you know, everywhere was fine. We had some tinnitus and, you know, shrapnel kind of, you know, I still have a picture that I kind of posted a while ago on Facebook where, you know, shrapnel kind of just, you know, cracked the Humvee, the windshield. But again, this was early on in the war, so IEDs weren't as strong at that point, but still, you know, you could see the shrapnel marks on it. But again, you know, lesson learned for that deployment, you know, for the rest of that deployment and just in life in general after that.
Were you in an up armor or
a soft skin? No, it was soft skin.
Soft skin.
Soft skin.
Yeah, it was early in the war. We didn't have those armored.
Yeah. So we had some bolted on Iraqi armor that we bought from like the local Iraqi junkyard. That's what we had at the time. So, but yeah, so that was pretty crazy story. But again, you know, just in life, like never stay complacent, always keep moving, always keep guessing, right? Not doing the same thing over and over. So,
and you know, just on that point, I mean, just to ask you guys, I mean, how I get asked that all the time. I mean, how do you stay vigilant? How do you stay, you know, just focused on the goal on a daily basis, whether it's, you know, in war? I mean, you get complacent in war. Think about, you know, some of these guys just in college every single day. I mean, how do you do that?
So, I mean, I think part of it is a big thing. So, I mean, you probably know like Jocko, right? Jocko's big on discipline, right? Like maintaining the certain standards. So, you know, Joe and I were up, you know, every day, regardless of how we feel, we go for runs, staying physically active, physically fit, but you know, you got to get and stay into routine. So I guess that's one of the things is, you know, I think that's a big part is like getting up early, getting after it, kind of focusing on the, and a lot of people, when they have a bad day, and of course everybody has a bad day, but then a lot of guys just end up like just sitting on the couch and, you know, and realize, you know, I'm gonna watch TV or I'm gonna eat junk food, and that doesn't solve anything, right? And you're allowed to have a bad day, but then realize, hey, you know what, like I can either sit here and just wallow in my misery, or I can just keep going forward and deal with what happens and just keep going forward. So that's part of, for me, I mean, you know, I get up in the morning, I go for runs, you know, Joe and I are training for the Marine Corps Marathon later on in the year. I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at night, right? That's, I've been doing that for like 7-8 years. So that kind of keeps me like mentally and physically kind of sharp. So that's for me, you know, how I stay vigilant, you know, and just, you know, keeping sharp, you know, and not staying complacent.
Yeah.
I know Joe has something on
that. I think I would say, you know, Justin, it's, you know, one of the common military catchphrases, but the enemy gets a vote.
Yeah.
And so you have to stick with your plan. You know, so we have certain goals we want to achieve in business and in life. But the enemy can come in and alter those plans. So, you know, one of your previous episodes, you're talking about, you know, the one where you were coming out of the SEAL delivery vehicle, going back down to the submarine, you had to hold your breath, and you had three plans, right? You're like, hey, there's a diver down there. He's got air. There's air once I get back into the sub, or there's the bubble, the operator of that section of the sub that you were going to get to. And that was your plan, to stick to it, all that. And as you're going down without your fins, cause you were like, oh man, I forgot my fins. You know, and you're trying to like, you're like, do I alter the plan and take the first available option, or do I stick with what I was going to do? And, you know, sticking with that plan was really important to you in executing that. And that's where you were going to get your air. And I think, you know, in business now, you know, we want to achieve certain things. We have certain goals and quotas that we're setting for ourselves to recognize. And we can't get deterred just because of the enemy or a friendly competitor doing something. Just because they do something doesn't mean you have to overreact or change your plan or adjust your goals. But you do have to acknowledge it, right? And you can't necessarily stay on that same path if it's not available to you anymore because the enemy blocked that path or made you change your plan. So it's important to do that prior planning, mission prep, and be prepared to execute your plan and then maintain that flexibility. So it's like, you know, wait a minute, that's conflicting message. It's like, stick with the plan, but be flexible. It's like, well, yep, that's the way it is. I mean, that's the way it is in the military. That's the way it is in life, you know, flexicute, right? Be flexible, but execute.
I mean, but for us, like after that, like that was like the first real kind of moment, like, shit, like this is real, right? Like this is real stuff. We're in Baghdad. And I remember like one of the other patrols, I remember I was followed, you know, we were following this one vehicle. I forgot why. And I was kind of staring at the license plates all in Arabic and see the signs of Baghdad. And I'm like, how the hell did I get myself here? Like I'm here and like driving down this middle of this road in Baghdad, like following tailing this one vehicle. It's like, what the hell, man? Like, this is crazy. Like, it was just so crazy. Like I was in, you know, from New York City. I was in Germany just 2 months ago. And now here I'm in Baghdad, like following this vehicle. But you know, it's so crazy. But again, when he goes to go back to complacency kill. So that's like one of the lessons again, I take to myself. And I think every day, the other one is kind of listen to experience. You know, there's always someone who's done something. So I listened to this one motivational speaker years ago, and he talked about have your own personal board of directors, right? In your head, like somebody who's physically stronger, they're faster than you, somebody who's mentally sharper than you, someone who's more financially sound than you, and kind of use their experience. And but like one of the things, so this was again in Baghdad, another patrol, and this is after like the second or third ID that we got hit with. We were, you know, now at this point we're all pissed off, right? So we're driving around Baghdad, and this was again at night, and we're off one of the main roads, and there was a building off, and we're getting pot shots from this building. But you know, it was like pot shots here and there with tracers, and I was pretty upset, and we were all pissed off. So I kind of tell my gunner, I was on the radio, I said, hey, the gunner was on with the 50 cal. I said, hey, just fire off a couple of shots in that building, man. Right? I said, just fire, because you know they're taking pot shots at us. I mean, it wasn't anywhere near us, but I say, hey, fire. My platoon sergeant gets on. He's like, LT, negative. We cannot shoot a 50 cal round inside that building when we're not taking direct. It's pot shots, yet it's not. We're not in direct threat. And this was on the radio. We're going back and forth, and I tell my you know, my gunner. I said, Nick, I said, listen, I said, open fire on that damn building. And we're going arguing on the radio, and then finally, you know, we have to pull the patrol over, and me and the platoon sergeant had to talk. He's like, sir, if you do this, he's like, this is going to be bad for us, right? For you, he said. I know we're pissed off. Everybody's pissed off right now, but we can't. You know, we have to maintain some standards, and you know, we can't just unload a 50 cal in a building where you know we have no idea who the hell's in that building. So again, so I acquiesced. I said, fine, Roger that, right? So, you know, again, I was pissed. But, you know, I listened to him. But then now years later, of course, I realized, I was like, man, like if he didn't speak up, and if I, you know, let my emotions get the better of me, like I probably would have been 11. Who knows what would have happened, right? Maybe war crimes. But, you know, and me and him are still good friends. You know, he retired a few years ago. But, you know, we had dinner in D.C. recently, because he lives in South Carolina, and we had dinner. We were just talking. I was like, hey, man, FYI, I was like, hey, thanks for keeping me out of jail that one time we were on patrol. So, but it goes back to just listening to experience, right? He was an experienced guy, you know, even though he was first deployment as well, but he kind of was thinking about the bigger picture, where I was kind of really focused on the emotions at that time.
Yeah. We can get inside of our own head, especially times like that, where we could justify so many things. And we have people around us that go, man, I don't know what you're thinking, but that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Are you really going to do that?
Yeah.
And you're like, wait a minute. I thought it was the best idea ever.
Yeah.
Like, so a lot of people to get, you know, kind of seclude themselves and are just kind of loners out there are making these, you know, just bad decisions in life in general. And you got to have that kind of group around you, you know, the close friendship that can call you out on your BS,
yeah,
you know, and save you, whether it's financially or relationship wise, like, hey man, you're screwing up right here. This is not going to go well.
Yeah.
And here's why. And I've had the same thing in my life, you know, and I've had to tell close friends of mine, like, yeah, hey, this is not the path you want to go down. And they, you know, what have you been thinking? Oh yeah. I've been just kind of all by myself over here, you know, coming up with these different ideas. And yeah, so that's a really great point, man.
Yeah. You know, and it goes back to, you know, I think when you get to a certain point, you realize that, you know, no one person knows everything, right? You need others to lean on. And, you know, of course, at that time, you know, I was 22, 23 years old. I was a first lieutenant in the Army. I thought my shit didn't stink, right? And, you know, I was like, you know, I'm a combat arms officer in deployment, but, you know, you learn, and, So that was, you know, again, so it goes back to even now, like, hey, you know, I know what I know and I know what I don't know, which is more important. So kind of lean on people with the experience. You know, the one other quick story, like inaction is action, right? If you don't, you know, doing nothing is an action of itself. So remember, so this was like probably midway through the deployment, well, like 5-6 months in, you know, we used to get the intel reports every day, you know, in the morning when we have our reviews. And there was one report where it was a Navy convoy. It was like a Navy captain. A Navy lieutenant, right? But he was a non-combat guy, and he was, you know, he was KIA. What happened was he was in a convoy, and it was a non-combat. You know, they were just going from one place to another, and they got surrounded by like a protest. So their whole kind of, you know, 5-6 vehicle convoy was, you know, 360 surrounded, and the Navy lieutenant was just sitting in his vehicle, and somebody pulled up, you know, walking in the crowd, you know, because hundreds of people in this protest or whatever it was, or in a busy market, and somebody pulled out a handgun, shot him in the head, and that's it, right? And nobody knew what happened. So that stuck out to me. I was like, wow, man, that's crazy that happened. But so then fast forward a week or two later, so we were in Baghdad near the Abu Ghraib section of Baghdad. So at that time, like Abu Ghraib, everybody knows Abu Ghraib prison, no. Right? Everybody knows Abu Ghraib prison, but that time in Baghdad in 03, Abu Ghraib was the only red zone. You know, we had the red, yellow, green of like how hot an area was. So Abu Ghraib at that time was the only red area in Baghdad, which was like meaning bad. Like you go through there, you're going to get engaged or something's going to happen. So we're on the way back to our FOB. And of course, there's a whole other story I won't get into, but me and my platoon sergeant kind of got into it. He wanted to take the long way back to the FOB. And I said, hey, sorry, that's going to add us like extra 30 minutes where we could cut through the Abu Ghraib market. And we'll be back over there. And I said, what are we scared about? We're the one with the guns, right? Let's just go through there. So, but when we get there, and this is broad daylight, like I forgot what day it was, but, we started cutting through the market. And then my gunner is like, hey, LT, there's an anti-US protest approaching us. And we look up and there's like 300 to 500 people approaching us with signs, pickets. And I'm like, oh, and there's nowhere else to go. Like we can't back up, you know, there's, markets all to the left and to the right. And so I'm like, crap, what the hell do we do? First thing I remembered was that intel report of that Navy lieutenant being killed. I said, listen, like these guys aren't going to infiltrate our patrol, however way, whatever, you know, their protest was. So, you know, I tell everybody to get out, dismount. We pulled 360 security. And I just started, hey, these guys, we're going to have to push them to the side of our patrol. Like they're not going to come in our vehicles, in our range. So we start, you know, I start giving orders, hey, make sure no one gets to this point. So these guys are approaching, like we're pointing our weapons at them, and you know, we're telling them, move to the side. And you see some of the guys in the market, they see what's happening, like, you know, these guys are approaching us, we have, you know, our weapons pointed at them, telling them to move to the side. And they weren't moving. And they got to the point, you know, I was getting ready to fire off you know, a warning shot to a couple of other kind of senior, kind of elderly guys in the market, kind of came to the crowd. And they actually did push them to the side because it was about to get bad. And so, you know, this whole big anti-American protest, whatever it was, kind of went to the side of us. You know, we passed, like they didn't break our 360 perimeter that we had on our vehicles. And, you know, we stayed vigilant. But so after we got back, so once the protest passed, you know, we got back in the vehicles, got back to the FOB. So funny, as soon as we get out, my platoon sergeant comes, see, LT, I told you. I'm like, sorry, I want to hear it, man. Like, you know, like you never could have guessed that was going to happen. But again, you know, that's to kind of make up for my story from before where I almost like ended up for war crimes, right? It's this one was, you know, good, just kind of taking, you know, if we sat there, like who knew what would have happened. And, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, of course, losing someone like that Navy lieutenant that was lost a few weeks prior, that was bad. But first thing I thought about was him, like, hey, man, we're not sitting in this vehicle, like sitting ducks and waiting for that to happen. So again, so inaction is an action.
Yeah, sounds like you had some real lessons learned on taking shortcuts.
Yeah, I would say that. But that goes back to being situational awareness, like knowing, like being flexible, and you know, hearing things and using the information that was garnered to you and applying it. But the last story I'll tell, a quick short story. This is actually a funny story. So this is pretty funny.
Good.
But yeah, this is a funny one. So this was toward the latter part of the deployment. We were on like Route Irish, you know, we were in like south of like South Baghdad now. And we had to, we were training the force protection guys, like these FPS, they were called FPS at the time. They were guarding the bridges and the tunnels in Baghdad. So these guys were guarding the different overpasses and the bridges, because a lot of the Al Qaeda guys were kind of bombing bridges or whatnot. And so we would go out there, you know, while we do our patrols, these guys are out there, these Iraqi dudes. And we hear on the radio, hey, there was one of our bridges or checkpoints. Some guys drove by, threw like a Molotov cocktail or something, like a bomb at these guys. We're like, all right, this just happened. Let's drive by and check on these guys. So we checked on them. We're like, hey, what happened? They're like, oh, these guys drove by in a vehicle. They threw a couple of like grenades, whatever it was. We said, okay, did you guys shoot them? Like, did you shoot back? They're like, no, we didn't shoot them. We're like, why not? They're like, oh, well, we didn't have any ammo. I said, well, we just gave you guys ammo like a week ago, like a couple of days ago. Like, what do you mean you don't have ammo? I was like, oh, well, so-and-so's sister got married. And so we shot off the rounds in the air to kind of stun the turkey fire, right? And I was like, are you serious? Like, we just gave you ammo a couple of days ago. And this is what you, so you're sitting here on this checkpoint with, you know, AKs without any rounds. Like if you're going to shoot it off, like, first of all, you shot it off, which is stupid, right? Like, you know, and on top of that, you're sitting on this, like sitting ducks, like at least tell us that you have no ammo, right? So it was so, you know, afterwards we get back, we're like, man, these are the guys that we're trying to train to kind of take over the country. And it's like, it's just mind-boggling, like, you know, the thought process on that. So now, you know, first we were like pissed, but now it's just kind of a funny story when people say, well, you know, how's that gonna happen? I was like, that's why for me, like, I don't have a big positive thing of like ever able to be going to take care of their own country when, you know, when you deal with stuff like that. So I don't know, that's just kind of a funny story, but
yeah, that's not atypical of training those guys.
I mean, there's videos of these Iraqi soldiers trying to do, you know, jumping jacks, right? And they can't get in cadence and stuff. So
no, all good life lessons there, you know, just taking action, not taking shortcuts, listening to those that may have a little bit more wisdom than yourself. Because leadership isn't always just about leading and making the decisions. It's about listening as well. And I think what you say there, you said action or non-action is an action.
Inaction is an action, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that's I think I was talking to somebody just a few weeks ago, a young guy, just he couldn't decide on what to do and what service to join. And I was like, well, the worst thing you could do is not make a decision. So regardless of what service you go into, it's going to be great. Go for it, man. Yeah. You know, I think this younger generation is just bombarded with all the information at their fingertips, where, you know, when we joined it, there was nothing, you know, and just like, okay, well, there's a little bit here and there, but, not like it is today. And they're scared of taking risks and making decisions and just going forward because they don't want to fail.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. You know, it's part of progressing is failing and just moving forward regardless. So no, great stories overall, guys. That was awesome. So just kind of wrap all this up because you got to get going, but how do people get in touch with you, Assault Forward, and everything that you guys are doing? Now that you're out of the military, maybe you can share, you know, on the interwebs and stuff like that. If somebody wants to reach out to you and talk a little bit about the Army or buy some of your products.
Yeah. So assaultforward.us is our main website. We also have assaultfwd.com because we found that we needed a .com to go with the .us. So lessons learned there from business, register a lot of different domain names that all point to the same spot. So assaultforward.us. And then we're at Assault FWD is our handle on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, Pinterest. you can find us across all social media platforms. But yeah, the DMs though on Instagram and Facebook from your audience have been great. So we appreciate the questions. You know, we're just a couple, you know, average Army veterans that just have a platform to tell our story. It's nothing special or unique compared to many, many others that have done similar great things. But you know, we're happy to share and give you anything we can back. Yeah, after the last episode, we'll put it back up there, is the discount code. If you use discount code military on our website, it'll give you a discount on your order. So our company For those of you who heard the last episode, it's professional accessories. So lapel pins, cufflinks, tie bars with the American flag in a subdued metal look. Pretty unique, pretty cool, we think. People seem to be digging it, so we're thrilled with that. We got some t-shirts out there now and some other stuff coming. So check us out on our website, our social media. Engage with us on any platform you want. We're happy to respond and answer questions and use that discount code that Justin will hook you up with, military. To get a little bit off your order. So, as always, Justin, though, we appreciate the opportunity to share, anytime, man. Plus, you know, as fans of your podcast ourselves, like I was telling you, we need to help you generate content, cause it's been a couple of weeks since the last episode. So we're wanting to hear more.
Yeah. I was on a little bit of a vacation there, but, we'll get back on it. Yep. No, it's been great. A lot of great lessons learned from your stories, guys. I appreciate everything you're doing and your service as well. So, Joe and Shaw, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Justin. Appreciate it, brother.
All right, guys. See ya.